Hello and welcome to the Ship Energy Podcast with me, Ariane Morrissey. In this special episode, we'll take stock of the extraordinary outcome of an extraordinary MEPC session. The meeting had initially been convened to decide whether to formally adopt the IMO Net Zero Framework, which would introduce the first global GHG pricing mechanism for international shipping. Instead, the week saw chaotic scenes and diplomatic twists, culminating in a vote on the last day, where a majority of IMO member states voted to adjourn the meeting for a year. As some delegates pointed out, much of the week's developments were shaped outside the IMO walls, as the United States put pressure on countries to block what it described as a carbon tax and threatened possible retaliation against those that would support the IMO Net Zero Framework. Today, we'll examine what the outcome of MEPC means for the maritime industry, for Pacific Island states that are already experiencing the impact of climate change, and for the environment. We'll start with John Taukave, researcher at the Micronesian Center for Sustainable Transport. He was technical support for the Vanuatu delegation, which was one of 49 countries that opposed the adjournment of the session and were hoping for the IMO Net Zero Framework to be adopted. So John, how did we get here? What is your analysis of how we went from a large majority of countries in favor of the deal in April to this decision to postpone discussions?
Initially, the Pacific, we abstained from the vote in 83 because the Net Zero Framework was not good enough. But we knew that it was a way to move forward. And so that's why we were willing to support the Net Zero Framework in the good faith that we could work on it more down the line instead of coming up with nothing at all, which would take years back, you know, in negotiations that we've constantly been putting, that we've been investing in. And so this decision to postpone the discussions was a huge disappointment on our end because it took us back. But, you know, reflecting on what happened, you know, when it happened fresh, it was it was very heartbreaking to see that discussions to adopt the framework was postponed because time is not on our side in the Pacific, because we constantly face the impacts of climate. And a year postponement means also a year of more further impacts in our region, like, you know, more sea level rise, more constant natural disasters. And so we really think of our communities in moments like that, because we come here for them. You know, we come here to make sure that our communities are represented, but also to make sure that our perspectives are heard in these discussions to be included.
But then what explains the fact that there was such wide support for the IMO Net Zero Framework just 6 months ago, and that today we have seen a majority of my member states decide to postpone those discussions?
Yeah. You know, as people say, it was an extraordinary session, and it indeed was an extraordinary session because there were several member states that applied pressure to many of the countries, you know, in trying to postpone, you know, postpone the adoption. And so our countries in the Pacific, we also felt this pressure of postponing the adoption, but I'm very glad that we made sure that our communities came first, and we made sure that the climate impacts, the science supported it, and it was a no-brainer to come and make sure that we could work on this Net Zero Framework.
Now, you talk about pressure. We saw the statement from the United States a few days before MEPC began, statement that outlined possible retaliation against countries that would vote in favor of the Net Zero Framework.
Yeah.
But could you tell us more about what discussions were actually happening behind the scenes before and during MEPC? What kind of pressure countries were under?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of our countries in the region, we faced pressure. Like we were given note verbales on making sure to postpone the adoption. There was also pressure on our governments at the highest level, because what was seen to be a technical discussion became very political, and then that included our leaders back home in having those discussions. But despite the pressures that faced from, like you said, from the US, The Pacific stood steadfast, and we knew how important these discussions on GHG was for us, and the adoption of this framework was not the best solution, but it was a solution that we could continue to work on. And despite those pressures, we still came out on top.
But now, do you fear potential retaliation from the United States for taking that stance at the vote?
There's always going to be that fear of further retaliation. But, you know, the best way, despite the disappointment, was to always to come back and to, you know, to come stronger, to be present and not just give up, not to let this postponement, you know, to let us down. You know, it was very disappointing, but you know, we still show up, we still come to work. You know, we came here for a reason and we came here for our communities. And despite the bad outcome, we still came to work. Like even like now in the intersessional working groups that we're doing now, we're still here. We're still participating in the discussions. We're still, you know, working on the guidelines, you know, the fund to make sure that in the hopes of, you know, us, you know, doing better or working better, doing more outreach, you know, it's more work, but it's needed. Because we need to be here for our communities.
And do you feel betrayed by some of the countries that decided to switch sides and were initially in favor of the IMO net zero framework at MEPC 83 and have now decided to either abstain or vote for the discussion to be adjourned?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say like feel betrayed. I think, you know, everyone was under pressure. Many member states were under pressure, and we understand their position that they had to take. But that does not mean that we hate them or we don't want to talk to them. This just helps us more to get the outreach there, to advocate for what this NZF will be like, and just to make sure that they understand, you know, both their technical experts and their political leaders as well, to understand what this means for all of us.
But how do you see the next year unfolding? Because we've seen that positions are very polarized. Yeah. As the Saudi Arabia delegate put it, this was a divided house. So do you think there are any realistic prospects of reaching a consensus in the next year? And critically, is there enough goodwill in the room to actually move forward?
I will always believe that there is goodwill to know that in this time and age, you know, the climate emergency is real, and to continue to do this outreach even to the other side. And I think outreach and making sure that we stand those who are strong on our positions, we, you know, re-emphasize on their positions and, you know, encourage them to more outreach. Like I said, there's more work to be done, and I'm very hopeful, you know. I'm going to stand with the position of my Pacific leaders in making sure that we still fight to make this and net zero framework be adopted. We're going to keep going.
But do you think you're in a bit of a David versus Goliath battle, as in you are going to try to do outreach in the next year? Presumably people on the other side of the debate will continue to do the same. So what's going to be your approach, and how realistic do you think it is that you can persuade countries that have bowed to US pressure to actually change their minds?
Yeah, I think that's the first thing to do is we're going to do outreach to solidify, you know, those who voted to, you know, not to postpone it, and solidify those positions, more outreach, more talks and more proposals, and just getting that conversation. And I think the second one is to do more outreach to the communities that are affected. And, you know, I think it's a clear sign of the pressure that, you know, states like the US can put, but to also remind them of the existential crisis that, you know, their countries are facing. And, you know, whether are we going to fall to the pressure, or are we going to fight for our communities? And I think a lot of outreach is going to be key for especially the Pacific and, you know, the EU and all member states who voted no.
You've mentioned the word communities a lot in this conversation, and we know that Pacific Island states are experiencing firsthand the impact of climate change. Mm-hmm. So in practical terms, what does this one-year delay mean for your countries and your mm-hmm. communities?
Again, one extra year means 1 year of more impact, more sea level rise, more natural disasters, more cyclones, more droughts, you know, and it's going to hurt us, but that will not defeat us. And despite all that's happening, we're still going to show up for our communities because we still do believe in multilateralism. And we hope that in good faith, we come to the agreed adoption of this NZF, because the science is there. The climate science is there. And what else do we need? You have the climate science, you have the real life experiences of communities, you know. We need this.
Let's now turn to Simon Bennett, who's Deputy Secretary General of the International Chamber of Shipping, who represents the Industry Association at the IMO. You made a powerful call during the MEPC meeting, saying that the shipping industry is absolutely desperate for certainty. So where does the decision to adjourn the meeting for a year leave the industry today?
It's certainly disappointing because it doesn't provide us with the certainty that we require, or ship owners require, in order to make some really expensive investment decisions when it comes to the green fuels of the future that will be required to achieve net zero by or close to 2050.
And so how do you think the industry should interpret the decision by the IMO member states? Is it the end of the IMO net zero framework, or what are the realistic prospects of a different decision in a year, given that the United States' opposition to a carbon pricing mechanism is unlikely to change?
Firstly, I should make it clear that the members of the International Shipping, which is the world's national ship owner associations, it will take them some time to digest the implications of what happened. So any comments I make are purely personal observations. I'm personally always optimistic, so I don't think the net zero framework is necessarily completely dead. But clearly, there were some very strong reservations from a large number of governments last week. So somehow a way has to be found to take account of those very serious reservations, not least, but not only from governments such as the US.
How did we get there? How did we get from a situation where we had an agreement at MEPC 83 in April, which had a support from 63 member states against 16, to a situation where a majority of IMO member states decided to postpone the decision?
I think it's very important to avoid getting into a blame game, but it's certainly the case that the agreement on the table last week, as many observers have pointed out, is extremely complicated. And although ICS has supported that agreement, and we felt that as it was the only option on the table, it was the best way forward, many of our members and many individual shipping companies certainly had concerns about the complexity of where we had ended up at the previous MEPC meeting, where this agreement was provisionally approved. Remembering that the final text was actually agreed in the middle of the night, with no one actually having a chance to provide any detailed input on it before it had to be approved by the committee.
So do you think that the outcome of the decision being postponed is a better outcome than a straightforward defeat of the net zero framework?
To be clear, before we began this week, the position of ICS was that we very much wanted the net zero framework as is to be adopted, because the alternatives would be far worse. And we were very concerned that It would be very bad for the shipping industry, because ultimately what's at stake is global rules for a global shipping industry, as well as wanting to do the best for the climate and the environment. But I think for the future, it's not, again, we've not yet to make any decisions in ICS, but the situation has changed somewhat, because the United States and others made their objections so clear that they suggested introducing the explicit amendment procedure. Now, that's a bit of an obscure technicality, but for the last 40 years, for routine changes to regulations, IMO has always used the tacit amendment procedure. And that was agreed between all member states precisely because what tended to happen is that governments would meet, agree some regulations, and then it would take 10 years for them to formally confirm that they should enter into force. Our fear is that if the precedent is created that governments can use the explicit amendment procedure, there's a real danger that it will make the future refinement of many other IMO regulations on other environmental issues, but also on safety issues, far more difficult. So without wishing to exaggerate, because existential is an overused word, but there's a danger that if that procedure was invoked again, that could make the IMO become something of a cipher of itself compared to the really effective organisation it's proved to be today in really increasing general standards of safety and, of course, environmental performance in the shipping industry. And I think objectively, if everybody would agree that there's always room for improvement, that IMO has been an incredibly effective organisation in that respect.
Now, many people, including the IMO Secretary General, have said that this was not the normal IMO meeting. So I wonder, do you think that discussions at the IMO have become too politicized? And do you think that this is doing the industry a disservice?
It's not doing the industry a disservice. We're concerned because IMO has always been a very effective technical regulator. So in ICS and our member national shipowner associations, we've always counted ourselves as IMO's number one supporter, because without IMO, without a global framework for rules, we have chaos in the industry. And IMO has provided this really effective framework for 50, 60 years. And in fact, the framework is even older than that, because the original SOLAS convention was adopted over 100 years ago, based on the same principle that on maritime issues have always been treated outside the normal realm of geopolitics. So although I'm not old enough, my old bosses used to explain to me how the beauty of IMO was that even in the days of the Cold War in the Soviet Union, you would see the US and the Soviet Union cooperating with each other on technical regulations, including pollution regulations, on behalf of international shipping. So I think everyone accepts the absolute critical importance of addressing climate change, but my observation would be that by introducing climate change policy into the IMO agenda, in addition to technical rate than the routine technical regulation, it certainly made the organisation more politicised. So there are similarities with the way that UNFCCC approaches its work. And having been to a few UNFCCC meetings, where it's very difficult to achieve agreement on anything, and the contrast with your routine IMO meeting, where even though everyone has different opinions, everyone is broadly agreed on the same goal of doing what is best, not for the shipping industry, but for having an efficient global maritime transportation system that's in the interests of the global economy. I mean, that's really what IMO's mandate is meant to be. So IMO has certainly become more politicised, but that's partly, of course, in recent years that it's been exacerbated by current geopolitical tensions that we're all aware of. But prior to that, there were problems.
And to finish, what do you expect the industry will do in the year ahead? Do you expect investment in energy efficiency or zero and near zero fuels to stall? Or is there enough incentive in regional frameworks to keep that going?
I mean, that's really too big a question to answer. Investments won't stall completely, and large parts of the shipping industry are committed to very serious investments in new fuels and new ships. But we are disappointed because we were hoping that even if we didn't have clarity this week or last week, that there was a possibility that we would have greater clarity very soon. And clearly, whatever happens, we are going to, the industry as a whole is going to have to wait a bit longer for that certainty.
And finally, I'm joined by Blonid Shirin, Policy Officer for Climate Diplomacy at Opportunity Green, to examine what the outcome of MEPC means for shipping's trajectory to net zero. So Blonid, what will be the impact of this one-year delay for the fight against climate change? If we look at the big picture here, is it still possible to reach shipping's decarbonisation ambitions for 2030, 2040 and 2050?
Look, this was a disappointing week. I'm sure you've heard that word being said many times. And I don't want to understate that, but I do also want to be clear that the net zero framework itself isn't dead. It is delayed. And of course, there are still many opportunities for various actors at domestic, regional level, and also corporate entities to really take leadership now. So I think what we can take from last week is, although at the international level, we've had this delay, and that has... it does have large consequences for us reaching 2030, 2040 and 2050. But of course, we can also now push domestic, regional, corporate actors to do better and to reach the standards that they themselves were calling for, but unfortunately we couldn't agree at the international level.
So do you think that the IMO is still the right body to be having these conversations about shipping's decarbonisation, or are regional, national actors more likely to be efficient in adopting that kind of regulation?
Yeah, I mean, of course, it's an important question considering the outcome of last week, but I think absolutely at the international level, the International Maritime Organization brings together countries and players from all over the world, and that it has such an important role in that regard. No matter the outcome of last week, I really think it's important to emphasize that international cooperation is the way forward in tackling climate change. It is a global problem, and we need to find global solutions, and we need to involve everyone in that discussion. And of course, the IMO could also be doing better and doing more to involve a truly global voices in the leadership of international decarbonisation of shipping. However, alongside the IMO, there should, of course, be domestic and regional leaders, and I think we'll really see that with the outcome of last week, that certain players will be stepping forward to evidence that they want to see more ambition, they want to see targets and increased incentive for industry and others to be involved in the decarbonisation journey.
You talk about climate ambition. Do you think that climate ambition more generally is losing momentum in today's geopolitical context?
So I can understand why that would certainly be a concern in the current geopolitical context, where we see key players really just trying to reinforce the status quo because it suits them perfectly well. However, politics is ever changing. I think that's something that we saw even last week. At the beginning of the week, there was maybe quite a different direction from what we ended up with at the end of the week. So what I will say with climate change is not politics, it is science, it is facts, it is not a sort of changing phenomenon in the sense of sort of maybe how politics might have certain key drivers at any one moment in time. And I think it's just really important to emphasize that climate change is a crisis of a generation and generations to come. So it's important to think of tackling it in the long term rather than sort of focusing on any current geopolitical context.
And now in the leading up to MEPC, a lot of people had described it as a test for multilateralism. So what does the outcome say about the role and the power of multilateralism? Do you think it's going to be more difficult to reach global climate agreements, either in the maritime sector or in other sectors?
Well, certainly, I think at the moment it is looking like it will be very difficult to make global climate agreements. However, I do want to underscore that we can't give too much power to certain actors. What we need to do is support those countries and communities that maybe feel like they cannot make the decision that is in their best interest based on their domestic context because they feel external pressure and influences. So I think moving forward, we need to really identify the concerns of all around the table to see what we can do to help people reach a place where they are comfortable and confident standing for climate ambition and standing forward at the IMO. And then, of course, supporting those who feel like they're being influenced by external powers in a way that perhaps has meant that they have had to disregard their domestic priorities.
And I want to talk about the next steps. So you attended the Intersessional Working Group on Greenhouse Gas Emissions immediately after MEPC, working group that's looking at implementation guidelines. What's the mood? Do you think there's a genuine will in the room to try and reach a consensus?
So I would say absolutely. And I think something that was really positive looking at the week of the intersessional session is that delegates immediately began that discussion of the guidelines that will allow for the implementation and the functioning of the IMO net zero framework rather than continuing to delay or say that we can't discuss those things. So that will really allow us to get down to the nitty-gritty details of what countries might need to hear to alleviate some of their concerns. So I'd say the mood in the room was, although ultimately people were very disappointed, including myself and as you might expect, the civil society members in the room, people were looking to the future, understanding that we need to identify key concerns in the room. Of course, there's a lot of details that still need to be discussed and decided. So people were, I'd say, in a collaborative spirit, looking towards, working to find solutions.
So looking ahead, do you think that there is a genuine chance for the IMO net zero framework to be adopted in a year when delegates have to decide on the matter again? Or is the text going to have to change? Are there going to have to be more compromises? What's your expectation on that?
It is hard to predict the future. So I think that's probably my answer to your question. But I am optimistic that in a year's time, we can help delegations come to a place where they're comfortable supporting the IMO net zero framework and it moving forward. Of course, with regards to will there need to be text changes, this delay has meant that there may need to be text changes. And then we need to understand better how that will impact the timeline and the timeline set out in the text, whether any text will need to be changed, etc. So that is an important consideration to be had. I do think that a lot of people are still really mulling over the outcome of MEPC and how that will impact all of our work going forward. So certainly there are some question marks that we're hoping to be able to figure out in the next weeks and months.
Blanet, thank you very much.
Thank you.